And good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Ordinarily, Phil Conlon is here, but Phil is away, but Phil is here, Phil Taylor. So we're going to talk to Stephen Gowans about our near-death experience over the weekend. And he has written two articles. We're trying to keep up with Stephen. And then in the second half, we really look forward to a second interview with Judy Reaver about her new book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. It's a very, very important book, and we look, as we say, look forward to that because it's rather there are very few good books about Rwanda in the English language. When I say that, I mean adequate books. And you might be hearing a little music along the way. We hope to play the song for Victoire Ingabire, who is in prison in Rwanda. And we want the world to remember that and to call for her release, and the release, of course, of Diane Wigara and her mother, who are in prison as well, which is a good backdrop to our interview for the second part of the show. Incidentally, that song for Victoire Ingabire is made to us gratis by Ann Garrison, KPFA, Berkeley. And I think we are joined now by the author, Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I'm here, Phil. Hello.
Hello. I have to remind everybody, you have a new book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. And you will be coming to Toronto. We look forward to that. You've written two articles, and I was just telling our listeners, we're trying to keep up. On the 15th, April 15th, you wrote an article with the title, First Step in Resolving Syria Crisis, Distribute Copies of the UN Charter to Washington, London, and Paris. And I may as well mention the second title. Today, you have written an article, and we'll get to both. A Prolonged War in Syria is on the U.S. agenda. So let's start with this matter of, I just told everybody, it was played as a near-death experience, and certainly it had all the necessary theater. We went through quite a weekend with the threats by the U.S. and question of what kind of response they would draw. And now we've reached the point where they've reconvened the United Nations Security Council, and they've begun to discuss this, what went on. Your formula would be if the Americans and the British, and of course today the Prime Minister of Britain is very in a kind of a corner because she has a parliament that wants to know why she didn't come to them to ask for permission to strike at Syria. Of course, in the U.S., they don't ask such questions because they understand the American president gets to do that. But what is the – you say that there were – clear speeches given in to condemn the United States for this and France and Britain for this aggression, but of course it was not actually covered in the media here. What was said there? Because you underline it in your article.
Yeah, and Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party in the UK, has written an article in the Guardian in which he says that the justification or the legal justification for the attack on Syria was questionable. Well, there was no question about it. I mean,
yeah, he'd been charitable.
Yes, I mean,
or wrong.
It wasn't questionable. It was illegal. There's no question about it. And this was brought up at the UN Security Council meeting by Russia, by China, by Bolivia, and by Syria. And the reference in the title of my article, Distribute Copies of the UN Charter to Washington, London, and Paris, that's not original to me. That comes from the Syrian representative to the UN, Bashar Jafari. And he was replying to, I believe it was the UK government, which asked for a plan of action to resolve the crisis in Syria. So he presented his own plan of action to resolve the crisis, and the first part of that plan of action was to distribute copies of the UN Charter to Washington, London, Paris, to make plain to them that they had blatantly contravened international law by undertaking an aggression against Syria, which is much as illegal. It's illegal because the UN Charter would only authorize an attack in the case of self-defense or if the use of military force had been authorized by the UN Security Council. And, of course, none of these conditions obtained.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. representative somewhere invoked the American Constitution? Am I right? I think, by the way, I've got the – I carry my Constitution around now just in case I need to defend myself. But I notice that they say that the power to make war is with Congress, but the little additional part of the sentence also says that if they're going to be allowing people to operate as pirates under their authority, they also need that authority from the American Congress. And if they're going to be seizing somebody's land, it says, if I understand it, I'm not a constitutional expert. But what do you make of that, the U.S. Constitution?
There was a discussion about this in The Intercept, I think, yesterday. And it was pointed out that the Trump government points to some justification it has for waging war against Syria that comes from a legal office that the executive consults. But the Congress and no one else is allowed to see what the justification is. Simply assured that there's some kind of legal justification, but I think, to use Jeremy Corbyn's words, there's some question about the legality from the perspective of the U.S. Constitution about any attack on or the waging of war on another country that's not approved by the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more pertinent question is, does it violate or international law? And there's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's time to ask this question. Why was the United Nations created, and who participated in that, and for what reason?
Yeah, I mean, the victor or the allies, those who won the Second World War participated, and they created an international order with the purpose of preventing another conflagration of the same ilk of the Second World War. And this is an international order that's based on the equality and sovereignty of independent states, that prohibits the use of force and the resolution of problems related to international relations.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an international order that the United States has rejected in both facts and words as well. I mean, words, if you look at U.S. U.S. national security documents, for example, the United States is quite plain that it supports an alternative international order. It's an alternative international order based on a hierarchy of states with the United States at the top and with all other states subordinate to the United States, in which international law or the rule of law is not something that applies to the United States.
Yeah, that was Madeleine Albright. I remember her rhetoric. She always said, we are the essential country. It's kind of like, you know, there's God and the Son and the Holy Ghost or something. But it is that's a political doctrine, right? I mean, they never really put their cards on the table and said, you know, we're going to remove the UN, but they stand there like a shadow. They don't accept UN authority over anything they do. I mean, they help create an international court, and then they said, but of course, we're not going to be a member. However, we will pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting entity. It seems to be – America is reminds me a little bit of Israel. There's a little bit of confusion as to what it actually is.
As to what it actually is. I'm sorry.
How it understands the limits of the world. I mean, the sovereignty of other states, et cetera. It doesn't share the philosophy embodied in the UN Charter.
No, not at all. It doesn't recognize the sovereignty or the independence of other states. You know, some have argued that the real embodiment of the UN Charter is North Korea. And they argue that because North Korea always makes the point that all countries are sovereign and independent and that other countries cannot meddle in their internal affairs. So you contrast North Korea then with the U.S. approach. The U.S. approach is that the United States is free to meddle in anyone's affairs and everyone has to submit to U.S. dictates. It's a complete rejection of this international order based on the rule of law and the UN and the idea of sovereignty and independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the and of course, say a U.S. molested Korea, and oddly enough, they had the words police action, where right. And we always associate the Americans with the concept of what they call the policeman, the world's policeman,
the marshal. Yes.
Yes. Yet, as you point out, in the case of Korea, they were not in the right. And Korea is more protected. Actually, Korea has called for the end of for the removal of nuclear weapons. They actually voted for that, right? For the, for an international agreement for mm-hmm. denuclearization.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they're on the carpet with a threat of preemptive attack.
And one of the reasons they developed their nuclear weapons capability is because at one point the Bush administration had put them on the list of seven countries that could face a possible nuclear attack, a list which also included Syria and Iran, by the way.
Hmm.
But that's only one of many reasons why North Korea has developed a weapons program. I mean, one of many reasons related to threatened aggression against their country by the United States, which, again, is another violation of international law.
Mm-hmm.
And if we talk about U.S. relations with North Korea or U.S. relations with Syria, U.S. relations with Iran, it's difficult to point to any aspect of those relations which have not transgressed upon international law.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really think of any. In Syria, I mean, we have the funding of guerrilla movements to overthrow the Syrian government. That's illegal under international law. We have the occupation of Syrian territory right now, as much as or almost one-third of Syrian territory. The territory east of the Euphrates is under U.S. military occupation. That's illegal under U.S. international law. Now there's a proposal to embed U.S. personnel within areas that are still under the control of the Islamist guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
And with the idea that they would call in airstrikes against the Syrian army if it attempts to recover its territory. That, too, I mean, is a blatant violation of international law. And as you pointed out, there's really no discussion about this in any kind of Western media.
Yes, far from it. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans. His book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, a story of Korea's struggle for freedom. And it is available now. I hope people go to that. It's Baraka Books. And I guess I better say something about Ottawa. Not a lot. I don't know that a lot needs to be said. But you talk about the U.S., U.K., France. Now, a year ago, we went through the same exercise in Aleppo. There was an announcement that there had been I don't know if it was in Aleppo, but there had been a chemical attack of some sort and claimed. And then Trump fired missiles within days. And the Canadian Prime Minister said at the time, first time they, you know, reporters caught him with, I guess, without his advisors, but he said into the microphone, that's terrible, chemical attack, horrible. We need to have an investigation and punish the perpetrator. But of course, the missiles were fired in the interim. And so when the next time he faced a microphone, about 48 hours later, he said, we fully support the U.S. action. Now, this time, he didn't bother to say anything about investigation. He just said, we won't be going ourselves, but we fully support it. I don't know what that means. But are you aware of anybody saying anything useful from one side of the Canadian Parliament to the other about this?
No, not at all. I mean, this is completely expected that they'd all, you know, salute the American action.
I thought not. I don't want to take up your valuable time with that, but it is kind of embarrassment. You use the word, you know, U.S. and its satellites, so people ought to look, see if Canada shows up under satellite. We're speaking to Stephen Cowens, and to get to your today's article, which is very important because it flows from what you've been saying and writing, you're speaking of the I'm going to read the title. Well, I don't have the title right, but here it goes. There is a too sanguine a view of what the U.S. is about, and then in fact, your estimate is that they're ready for the long haul, and to see if they can occupy territory and hold it, and this comes in is linked to the issue of. They're not doing that well in terms of preventing the success of the Syrian army in removing the most nasty groups that had dug in very well, actually, and been very well armed and had been firing missiles and mortars into the city of Damascus. The Syrian army succeeded in that quarter. However, let's get to this matter. The U.S. is holding, as you said, east of the Euphrates, a big piece of real estate under which is a lot of oil. We all remember from Iraq, that seemed to be a big factor. But there are other complicating matters for them. You say there is a type of argument going on, the ones who are prevailing are those who are want to see if they can stay for 1,000 years.
Yeah, U.S. policy vis-a-vis Syria has always been about nurturing or bringing about fostering an orderly transition in government from Assad's ideologically inspired Arab nationalists, which is what Washington doesn't like. It doesn't like its Arab nationalism, to Sunni business people who are more interested in making money than in politics. I mean, this point was made in a CIA document that has been declassified for some time, but for some reason has come up in some circles lately. But that has been the U.S. policy for quite some time. And the policy has never been to drive or to topple the Assad government. And because there's a fear that if that happened, that the successor government would be led by ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Muslim Brotherhood, and Washington certainly didn't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. So they've always been careful not to tip the balance too far in favor of these Islamists that they have provided arms and resources and training to. I mean, the role of the Islamists was simply to create a quagmire in Syria.
Yes.
And with the hope that the Arab nationalist government would eventually arrive at the conclusion that their cause was hopeless, that this war was going to go on endlessly, and that they would have to accede to some kind of negotiated transition to a U.S.-approved government.
Sort of the Afghan strategy.
Yeah.
Because there they sit. The whole place a mess, and Trump having dropped the mother of all bombs, he said. Make sure everybody was awake and aware he was doing things.
And Mattis had revealed what the strategy was at the beginning of this year. And I think Mattis is the one who is behind the strategy that's been attributed to Rex Tillerson of the open-ended occupation of Syria east of the Euphrates. He talked about how the U.S. strategy is now one of holding territory rather than acquiring new territory in Syria. And that the goal was to invest in the reconstruction of those areas. And others talk within foreign policy, so I should back up. Trump probably objected to that because that's going to cost the United States money. And he's had conversations with the Saudis trying to get them to pony up and provide the reconstruction funding.
Well, they paid for the Iraq war against Iran.
Yes.
And for the Kuwait exercise, the Saudis reached into their little pocketbook and paid for that.
And it seems like they also paid a lot.
Yankee traders are tough characters. I'm going to clean that thing, and you're going to pay for that.
They also contribute a lot to funding the Islamist guerrillas in Syria.
Yes.
But the idea has been to hold that territory, to reconstruct it, to develop it, to bring it back to normalcy, while at the same time denying reconstruction funds to the areas held by the Syrian government.
Mm-hmm.
Important in this strategy is the fact that the U.S. government now has control of Syria's petroleum assets, which the Syrian government cannot use for reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And so this becomes an exercise in that's really a blackmail, essentially, yeah. It says.
And it's also everybody's long game, right? Because the Russians are able to say clearly, by the way, let's be very clear, they're invited there, very important legal point. They're there. And they say, we have an agreement with Turkey and with Iran and ourselves and Damascus that the territorial integrity of Syria is inviolable. And the U.S. says, well, we're going to sit on this part. So those are the two hands you're playing. One guy has aces, the other guy has jokers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you this about, isn't this a pattern of empire, though? I mean, frankly, the United States is sitting in Guantanamo. That's an important piece of Cuban real estate. But the Cubans, who've had a revolution and have told the Americans to please go, have to live with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And China had a revolution, and they ended up, the British kept Hong Kong, and the Americans, British, and everybody else hung on to Taiwan, which they still have. And empires kind of play that way, don't they? And after the Russian Revolution, the white armies moved in, including Canadians, and tried to hold on to territory.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of create an opposition government, the whole exercise.
Right. But in this case, the idea is to hold on to territory, to develop it, to convey the message to the Syrian population, look what happens if you cooperate with the United States.
Yes.
You'll get development funds. The way to unlock those development funds, the reconstruction funds, mm-hmm. is to pressure your own government to step down, to have a transition.
Yeah.
The other advantage to the United States is to invoke, Che Guevara's strategy of weakening the United States by creating not one, not two, but three Vietnams. But the view in some U.S. foreign policy circles now is that prolonging the war in Syria hands Iran, what they call the Ayatollah's Vietnam.
Yeah.
So let's engage them.
Yes, and as Brzezinski said, that Afghanistan was going to be Russia's Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly.
So, by the way, have you noticed that in imperialist circles, they like to try to think like communists? They seem to be out of ideas. Like, if Mao had an idea, let's try that. That one last point before we go, I want to make sure I bring this in. I'm sure you're noticing it. But, of course, Americans do not like Trump. That's just one of their strategic problems. They're not infatuated with the leader. Certainly the world isn't infatuated with him. But when he attacks someone, of course, we all know the Americans rally around the flag. And people like Bernie Sanders, who all the left wants to like, he said when the remark was made by Trump, I think we should pull out of there. Bernie Sanders said, oh, we can't do that. I mean, he was against going in. He was against adventurism. However, he said, you can't just pull out. And that pretty much sums up the problems people face in the U.S. on this matter of war policy, doesn't it?
Yes. And I think that one of the reasons why the United States does what it does and, looks for pretext to launch aggressions is because it can hold itself up as the guarantor of some international moral order.
Mm-hmm.
As the, the marshal, the protector of international law, while it transgresses international law itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very few people in the United States who have the courage to challenge that.
So I understand the Sanders motif. It is that we do represent virtue somehow, and therefore we can't pull out.
Right.
And, well, that's why people should read Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and I congratulate you on this book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, A Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. Stephen Gowans, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
And you too. Thank you, Phil.
Okie doke. Bye-bye. Data Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I think we have a little music.